All right, welcome to Truth Be Told. This is Tony Sweet and Captain Ron. We're excited because just a few weeks away, Contact in the Desert is here. And if you haven't got your tickets, please go to contactinthedesert.com, and we'll be there. And today's guest is one of the main speakers. We got to see him, but he was so exhausted because he had so much going on during the event that we couldn't sit down with him. But today we get to ask the questions that we know that you guys want to know. And but today we have Michael Tellinger on the show. Michael is a author, scientist, politician, explorer who has made groundbreaking discoveries about advanced vanishing civilizations in South Africa. He has presented Adam's Calendar as a site of extraordinary archaeological importance, being at the center of a network of stone circles across southern Africa, which purportedly channeled energy in ancient times. So we're going to get into details right now with the one and only Michael Tellinger. There he is. How you going? How you doing, sir?
Hey guys, good to speak to you again. Nice to see your faces, and I look forward to seeing you at Contact in the Desert very soon.
Yeah, we're excited, and I know we're just going to jump right into it because time will go fast, and we won't get all the questions.
I know, this is another one of these 10-hour guys that we could just, there's so many things. You are getting more and more involved. Michael's been involved in everything now from politics down there to giants, which we're going to get to in a minute. But first, let's just start with your mainstay, which is these stone circles. You've studied them so long now. What are you coming away with? What's going on with these stone circles? What are they?
Well, we have a pretty good idea what the stone circles are. What remains a mystery is what were they really used for? There's no question or no doubt that they are energy-generating devices, and they all form one giant energy-generating grid. There are, in my estimate and a rough calculation, that I did some 10 years ago by studying them from aerial photographs and seeing the density and calculating the number of stone circles per hectare and per square kilometer and so forth, and then extrapolating that to the whole area that the stone circles are found in. I calculated there are approximately 10 million or possibly more of these structures.
10 million? That's insane, Tony.
No, it's ridiculous. This makes South Africa, or Southern Africa, should I say, because it includes Zimbabwe, obviously, as well. It makes Southern Africa the home of the largest concentration of ancient ruins on Earth. I don't know anywhere else. I have not found anywhere else where you find such a large number of stone structures, ancient ruins. These ruins have been known about for 500 years. When the Portuguese first came around the Cape of Good Hope in 1488, they already discovered the stone structures at that time. And when they asked the locals who built these structures, they were told very clearly that the locals that they met, the African tribes, did not build those structures. They just occupied and used them. This goes back to a whole another mysterious past. And I guess I've been fortunate enough to uncover the mystery, and I've been studying them now physically, walking among the stone circles since 2007.
So, Michael, I just want to ask you this real quick. Why is it, I mean, with so many and it's so significant, why do we not hear about this too much?
Like, the average guy on the street would have no idea what these are.
You hear about the Mayans and the Egyptians and, you know, all these other ancient sites, but we really don't hear much about these ruins.
Well, I'm the only guy that's really researching it, studying it, and writing and talking about it. The mainstream academia in South Africa has completely shut this down. And there's an interesting standoff at the moment between me and the academia, is that they've been really, you know, calling me all kinds of things since 2007 and early 2008, when I first released the first book, Adam's Calendar, about this. And just making up stories and lies and publishing their own books and their own wild theories and completely unscientifically based, origins of these stone circles.
Well, what are they saying it is? What do they say that they are?
Well, they say these are dwellings for people and cows that were built by African tribes no further back than about 400 years ago. That's
And they don't even look like that. Who would live in that?
Right.
Well, exactly. It's I don't even want to go into that. The point is that if the mainstream academia now comes out and admits that what I've been saying is right, that means that everything they've been saying about me is wrong, and they don't like to be seen to be wrong. And, you know, so it's a problem for them right now. So it's the stone circles are getting more and more attention, I must say. What they've done unquestionably is they've opened the door to a deeper understanding of ancient technology, ancient civilizations, and the technology that they used. And that is, I guess, my area of expertise and research, which I found and researched and measured. So there's no question about it. We're dealing with the stone circles themselves that generate insane amounts of energy, sound frequencies, magnetic fields, electromagnetic fields. Adam's calendar is off the chart. It's like the centerpiece of these structures. They're all connected to each other with these channels. You know, they don't just stand alone. So we're dealing with a giant energy-generating grid of structures all connected to each other.
Are we able to harness that today?
Well, we could. We can harness that today. And that's really part of what I do in my lectures and my workshops is discuss the science and the technology behind this. Because believe it or not, the cell phone companies today are already utilizing this technology, but they're keeping it very quiet. They're not sharing that with the rest of the world because that means they're going to have to share that technology with the rest of the world, and they're not going to do that because then they're going to be in opposition to the energy generating companies, and they're all, you know, part of the big cabal. So,
and that's the other fight you got going on down there is you're fighting the cabal, yeah.
Yeah, look, we're making very good progress, yeah, with the Ubuntu movement, and this is really why this discovery and this research is so important because it highlights very clearly how everything is connected and how you have to study so many different areas and subjects from history to archaeology to geology to electronics to electricity to money, cuneiform tablets, Sumerian texts, astronomy, quantum physics, magnetism, all this stuff. If you don't study all these different areas from anatomy as well, you know, and if you don't study this, you can't connect the dots. This is why our poor archaeologists have not been able to put it together, because you know they only focus in one area. And if you start talking to them about sound resonance and frequency, they think you lost your mind.
And I think it should be the opposite. It seems to me like there should be this just tons of people running down there to join you and figure this stuff out. This should be at the head of CNN every night, and it's not.
Well, you know why. We all know why. So I'm not asking those questions anymore. So I'm making my journey and my duty to share this information with as many people as possible and to attract the tourists and the people to come here. It's because through the money that I generate via people that come here on a tour or a journey with me, and I'm doing more and more of these specialized stone circle research expeditions, which are actually the events that have been bringing the new discoveries that are just mind-blowing, especially the fossils, and we'll get to the fossils.
Well, yeah, your claims lately and your discoveries are getting more and more wild, and I don't think where you even expected them to go. Why don't you talk about some of these rocks you're finding that look like rocks, and then you looked at them and it looks like, well, maybe that could be somebody's foot or arm, and it turns out you think they're these giants.
Well, I don't think so anymore. We know this now. You know, once you've been in a museum, you've seen the fossils because they start from small fossils and they get bigger and bigger and bigger. The big ones are obviously lying in the mountains. I can't pick them up and bring them to the museum. They're too big. So I can only show the small ones that I can lift up and bring in and exhibit. Then I show videos of the others and pictures of the others. I'm actually starting a new channel, which will be hopefully a funding mechanism for more research. And this channel will have weekly 20 to 30 minute episodes on new discoveries and so forth. So there's no doubt in my mind, and And anyone that's come to visit me and come see the museum, when they come take a tour with me, and people walk out of here just completely blown away by a complete shift in perception of their perception of human history, human origins, and what's been going on here, you know, for a long, long time.
Well, yeah, Tony just showed this giant foot. I mean, that's incredible. What could possibly have made that?
Is remarkable. And once again,
it's hard to deny.
I mean, yeah, look at that.
And how geological formations are created, if you follow the mainstream geological nonsense that they teach you at geology school, you'll forever remain confused. And this is where this this additional research and hands-on experience and knowledge becomes really critical. Otherwise, we make no progress.
Do you have somebody like Scott Walter, like a forensic geologist? Do you have anybody that like that working with you in carbonating this and verifying these, you know, possible bones or?
Yeah, look, we there's no money.
Right.
There's no for carbon dating or anything like that. Literally, it's show and tell. It's discover, share, show, and tell the people. Show the people. Because once you've been in the museum and you've seen the fossils, there's no question. You have no more questions. You don't have no more doubt,
right.
Should I say.
Right.
No doubt that these are actually fossils and body parts. What happens here, and again, people don't know. The general public and geologists, even experts in geology, don't know how fossils are created because they don't really study that. They don't understand the scientific and the chemical and the electrical principles behind fossilization, petrification, transmutation, all the different things that happen at the same time. You know, you can't have a discussion with these people about this. They just don't have enough information. So right. At the moment, I guess I've become a global expert on this subject because I've been doing this for 13 years, longer than anyone else. So they should be coming to me to learn instead of me going to some...
That's what I keep saying. Why? There should be this attention. You have this. Don't you have skeletons that are like 7 meters tall?
No, I don't have the skeletons. There is a skeleton, however, in Ecuador, in a museum in Ecuador of a 7 meter tall giant. And that would have been the kind of being, maybe 10 meters tall, that would have left that kind of size footprint. And you know, fossils can happen. Let's put it this way. Most geologists and the average person on the street, based on the current information, believe that fossils take millions of years and at least 10 or 15 or 20,000 years, right, when fossilization starts.
I would think that, wouldn't you, Tony?
Right.
And that is completely incorrect. Hmm. The moment you start studying fossils and fossilization and very brilliant researchers, scientists, and experts in their field, you realize that once you introduce mud, water, and we're talking about mud fossils here. We're not talking about bones being left lying around in open air and so forth, and then they start to crystallize and transform and et cetera. It's magic that happens here. We go from a carbon-based structure into a silicon-based structure. So this is actually transmutation and transformation and metamorphosis that happens here. And that's not supposed to happen based on mainstream science. You know?
I want to ask a question, kind of what Kate in the chat room was asking, and I was going to ask this earlier. How do you protect these? How do you protect them to not getting – like I remember back in the early 1900s, they said they found some – ancient Egypt artifacts in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Smithsonian came in, wiped it out. You can't even find evidence of anything anymore. I know you can't, you know, wipe out 10 million ruins.
Well, this is why I've got the museum. Okay. I have a museum filled with probably close to 1,000 tools and artifacts, from the cone-shaped tools to the torus stones that we need to mention because this is really the centerpiece of the ancient technology. The torus stones and the cone-shaped tools, that together with the sound frequencies that are generated by the stone circles, and also on top of that, the magnetron ruins, the magnetron-shaped ruins, which we need to explain as well.
Yeah,
I have hundreds and hundreds of fossils. In fact, I've stopped collecting the fossils now because I've run out of space in my museum. And And it's just getting crazier and crazier. And the more I work with it, the more your eye gets sensitized and you start to recognize things. You become an expert in this thing. You know, as Malcolm Gladwell says, you got to do 10,000 hours to become a master at something. Hmm. Well, I calculated the other day, I've done about 36,000 hours. So I'm way beyond the point of being a master at this. So,
right.
I speak with relative confidence about these subjects.
Well, let's talk about some of these tools. Like, yeah, the cone-shaped tools seem like a unique thing.
Yeah, that's, I guess, probably my great contribution to archaeology and technology discovery. Because when I started collecting these cone-shaped tools, completely subconsciously, when I first arrived here in the mountains of Mpumalanga, South Africa, among the stone ruins, they're not just here, they're all over, but this is the highest concentration of the ruins, and you can literally just walk out of your front door and walk through the mountains and they're everywhere. Are collecting strange-shaped stone, the stones, the elongated stones that ring like bells, the cone-shaped tools, and other weird stones that just had shapes that I couldn't understand, and I was wondering why they had these weird shapes. So I started collecting these stones and the cone-shaped tools, and then I started being gifted the donut-shaped stones or the torus stones, and little did I know that the cone-shaped tools, not all of them turned out to be cone-shaped tools, but the shape led me to investigate cone-shaped tools in history. And that became the biggest discovery. Hmm. Realized that all ancient cultures have cone-shaped tools at the center of their technology.
Really?
Use these for building temples and levitating stones and cutting and doing whatever they were doing. Realizing at that stage, obviously, that we're dealing at something that would have been used to focus sound into what we would call today a sazer beam, as opposed to a laser beam. They used sazer, they used sound. And again, I have to go back to the big discovery of the stone circles being generators and amplifiers of sound frequencies, sound resonance, magnetic fields and electromagnetic fields, and sometimes incredibly powerful energies through the magnetron-shaped ruins. They used sound and resonance for everything that they did. So this is the big discovery here. And this then led me to very quickly and easily decode the temples in Egypt, the pyramids, Borobudur, Sacsayhuaman, all the ancient sites on Earth pretty much are all energy-generating devices, like giant circuit boards and so much more. These are not temples for people to go and worship and pray and offer food and kiss the butt of some god or whatever. You know, this is
and they're not burial tombs,
right? Have you found any type of burial tombs in that area around the ruins?
No,
none.
No. We're dealing with Anunnaki sites, so this is very important. Again, this is a very clear link. We have the Sumerian texts that talk about the gold mining and how Enki, the supreme Sumerian deity, set up the gold mines here in southern Africa, which they sometimes refer to as the Abzu. And this gets very confusing. It's like in the English language or many languages, different words can often be taken up in different meanings. And in Sumerian, the word Abzu has exactly that connotation. It was used to describe various situation scenarios or places. But one of those scenarios is described as the Abzu was where Enki set up the gold mines in the deep Abzu, and that would be Southern Africa, South Africa and Zimbabwe specifically.
So you feel that Zachariah Sitchin's stuff is spot on about the 400,000 years ago Anunnaki used us as slaves to mine for gold?
Well, I wouldn't say it's spot on. There are definitely misinterpretations. No question about it. But even if he's 10% accurate, and even if he just pushed us in the right direction, then he's already done us a great favor because right. He's taken us away from that ridiculous thought of all the other crap that we've been told about our origins, you know?
Totally. And aren't some of these mines that you're finding more technologically advanced than the ones that we do today?
Oh, boy. I'll be talking about this in detail at Contact in the Desert, at my lectures and my workshops. And also, obviously, as I always do every year, after Contact in the Desert, I go on an extensive tour of the USA. So Contact in the Desert is the big daddy. That's the big annual event where everyone who's anyone is, all the researchers and lectures there are just spectacular. So I really kick off the platform there for the USA tour. And I'll be talking, I'm doing three long lectures there at Contact in the Desert. I'll be going into great detail about the gold mining, the technology used, and the new information. It's just constant, never-ending new information that keeps coming out. The more you dig, the more you find. But at the same time, the more confusing it becomes.
Yes. I think you have this giant plethora down there of this. You hit like the mother load. There's so many different avenues. I don't know why people aren't just pouring down there to look into this stuff.
And just so you know, the Brian Forrester is in our chat room and says he can't wait to see you at Contact. And
send Brian my love. I love Brian. He's my brother in arms down in South America. And I can't wait to go visit him and see all his amazing sites that he's exploring down in Peru and Bolivia and everywhere else. And then bring him here, because I think only once you've been here and you've walked with me and I've shown you what there is, that's when the penny really drops. And I see it. It happens to the people that come on my Stone Circle research expeditions. They sort of arrive. They're full of excitement and they don't quite know what to expect. And then as we start going up the mountains, and the penny starts to drop, and the realization is that you are here. You're among these structures that were built by the Anunnaki, and survived 300,000 years and possibly more, survived several floods, not just one flood, but several floods. Most of the ruins lie buried below mud and sand. Some of them have been exposed recently, and those are the ones that have been reused and remodified and re-inhabited by migrating tribes and used for other reasons and other purposes. And this is what confuses our poor archaeologists and historians. They just, you know, their poor brains can't deal with the deeper knowledge and information because they just don't have enough knowledge.
I wish we had the resources to, we could dig this up and really, you know.
And how did it be preserved so long and still stay on the surface with that many 300,000 years? How is it not buried? Is it just...
It is buried. That's the thing. The fossils have now brought a new interesting element into this research, because fossils obviously have to occur in mud and water. So at some stage, there must have been a flood, and a large water and mud would have just covered everything here. The mountains are covered in mud. In fact, on tops of the mountains around me here are layers of mud, and you know, I'll show pictures of that in my presentation, where you can actually see the layers of mud and the fossils are sticking out of the mud, and many of them are now lying on top of the mud sliding down the mountain.
Oh, wow.
Stage. There was a big flood that covered all these ruins and this whole area in mud and water and sand. And all the creatures and beings and possibly some Anunnaki were trapped in that mud and then very quickly turned to fossil. You know, all you need is a couple of lightning storms and the lightning strikes hitting the water and hitting the mud, and that releases neutrons, and it creates a chemical chain reaction that creates fossilization. Literally, not in thousands of years, not in years. It can happen within months, weeks, and sometimes even days. Amazing. You can literally fossils within days, and this is information that most people do not have.
No. Isn't it true that mud fossils, you can also extract DNA from those?
Yes, and my friend Roger Spur, that runs Mud Fossil University, really, it was his work that brought me to thinking align with or start to think about these rocks. When I started looking at his work regarding mud fossils some 2.5 years ago now, I was just blown away by that, you know. And you start out as a bit of a skeptic and start looking at this and go, okay. And then I started walking up the mountains here and looking at the weird stones that I've been collecting for 11 years in my museum, and they ring like bells. And then suddenly one thing happens and it changes everything. You know, once I was blind, now I can see.
Yeah, you said you used to joke that, God, that kind of looks like a foot. And then you picked and they think it was a foot.
Yeah. Well, the
fossilized,
you know,
foot.
We are, I have ribs of creatures. I have hearts. There was butchery going on here. There was butchery. There's legs, limbs of creatures and beings, and the organs that have been taken out. It's like walking past a butcher and seeing legs of lamb and beef and pork hanging in the butcher shop and steaks being carved. We have stones, fossilized rock that look like pork chops and lamb chops. And that's just ridiculous.
It feels to me like you could take that DNA and prove that this is another race or another whatever and get more attention to this. Isn't that possible?
Yeah, it will happen. It will happen. It just Good. Needs funding. Right now, it's just day to day going through the missions, trying to get people to come here, take a tour, and keep bringing the funds through so that we can finish the museum one step at a time. You know,
I wish I had a lot of dough. I'd write Forrester and him a check, right? And just say go crazy.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What a dream trip would Brian Forrester and Michael Tellinger going down to South Africa. That would be like a dream trip. But Brian actually wanted to know: are you bringing fossils to Contact this year?
I'm thinking about it. I was in the museum earlier today and I picked one small fossil up that's got claw marks on it and teeth marks. You can see where the creature clawed in it and then little teeth marks nibbling at the bone and where the marrow was sticking out. It's all rock now, but you can see, you know, it's obvious. I was thinking of bringing that one along with me.
That'd be awesome. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I'll probably bring one or two little pieces with me. You know, this is the strange thing. I started collecting these rocks, you know, in early 2008, completely subconsciously, not knowing why I'm collecting them. And sometimes you know, 11 years later, I look back and go, thank God I picked up these rocks.
Absolutely. How fascinating. You didn't even know what they were at the time.
Talk about the little
God,
voice.
That's amazing.
The little
but
voice
something
in your
compelled
head.
Him to say, I should keep this.
Yeah.
I love that. That's awesome.
The very first fossil, which is a long leg bone, and by the way, the reason why these long, especially the elongated stones, why they ring so beautifully is because, first of all, it's bone, was covered by meat and muscle, and filled with blood. And what is blood full of? Blood is full of iron, right? So now you've got this leg that just fossilizes and all the iron inside together with a crystal that, you know, the carbon that turns to crystal. Now you got quartz and iron together. What a perfect combination. This is why they ring so beautifully.
That's awesome.
Once you start connecting the dots, it's very easy to figure this stuff out.
That was a super quick 30 minute. We got to take a quick break here. We're going to talk about Contact in the Desert and we'll be right back.
Join me, George Norrie, in Indian Wells, California, for the 7th Annual Contact in the Desert UFO Conference, May 31st to June 3rd. Contact in the Desert is an epic weekend of adventure filled with exciting explorations into ancient aliens, human origins, crop circles, UFO sightings, disclosure, and the newest evidence of ongoing contact. This amazing weekend offers over 50 lectures, 40 workshops, 8 exciting panels, special events, and a luncheon that I'm hosting. Contact in the Desert also features leading experts including Giorgio Tsoukalos, David Wilcock, Linda Moulton Howe, Michael Tellinger, Eric von Däniken, Doc Wallach, and many more important researchers and scientists in the field. Contact in the Desert is your place for inside information. Join us at thecontactinthedesert.com to get your tickets today. It's time to make contact. That's contactinthedesert.com. Don't miss it. Contactinthedesert.com.
All right, we're back. This is Truth Be Told, and I'm Tony Sweet. We have Captain Ron over here. We're talking to Michael Tellinger.
From South Africa.
Not South Florida, but South Africa. But we're excited because Michael's going to be at Contact. We hope you guys get your tickets and come see him, and make sure you come up and say hi to us, too. We'd love to see you guys. But Michael, I want to ask you this. Since this was kind of the origin of, you know, how human existence,
the cradle of mankind,
and so around the world they've had to have, you know, similarities, because, you know, it's like, you know, your family, you kind of go off your family genes. Where do you see the most similar ruins or architecture around the world compared to this?
Yeah, good question. I must admit, I have found stone circles pretty much all over the world. You know, there's stone circles in the USA, in Canada, all over Europe, and even on Easter Island, there's stone circles that have been damaged and destroyed. South America, in the deserts, stone circles pretty much everywhere, but nowhere is there a concentration and the density of the stone circles that we found here in South Africa that are so well preserved and accessible because they're on farmlands and the farmers don't know what they are. However, they are obviously being destroyed through plowing and farming and road building and town and city development. So that's a big problem and it goes on all the time. But there are still, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of these ruins all over the place in South Africa and also Zimbabwe. And now, to compound the problem, the fossils have really thrown a cat among the pigeons because now it is confusing the timeline because many of the stone circles, many of the ruins are built with body part fossils.
Oh, my God. That's new.
Yeah, this is a huge shock.
You know what you have there, Michael, is the more you know, the more you don't know, because it just keeps getting more and more insane.
It's just crazy. Like, so what happened here? What is the timeline here? So we know that the Anunnaki are responsible for these stone structures. And I say this with great respect to the people that, you know, that question the source of information and intelligence and research and so forth. Keep in mind, I've been doing this for a long time. I cannot share all the sources of research, all the information that have allowed me to connect the dots and reach conclusions. It's been a long journey. So the conclusion I have reached through research since 2007 till right now, and every day I make more discoveries, is that these structures are Anunnaki installations. And they may have been manipulated and improved by the Anunnaki. They may have been built by prior civilizations.
Oh, my God. Older than that. Are you putting a date on this, Michael? 300,000, 400,000? Where do you put this?
Yeah, it could go back even further back in time. Yeah. So then the Anunnaki come and they fix it, or they either build it or fix it. Either or, it's a little unclear. What we do know is how they built the stone circles, and at this stage, it seems that the main reason for the stone circle building was terraforming and creating a giant machine that can actually create an atmosphere that makes the Earth habitable. And that's what this giant machine is for. This is why it is so big, so vast, it covers most of Southern Africa, because it was probably generating oxygen to fill the atmosphere. And that is the conclusion I've reached at the moment.
Wow. What if we could turn that on again now?
We need that right
now. We need oxygen, right? This could solve our carbon dioxide problem.
Right.
Well, we know how to do that. Keep in mind, guys, we know how to do all these things. But it's not going to happen unless we get rid of the puppet masters that are running the world today and free the people so that they can use their creative skills and creative talents and their knowledge, the scientists, the inventors, put them to work. There are thousands and thousands, if not millions, of scientists, inventors, brilliant minds that know how to do all these things. In fact, we're doing this on Mars. We're planning to do this on Mars. They're planning to create, I mean, watch the NASA videos. They tell us how they're going to go to Mars and create an atmosphere, create oxygen, and how they're going to do it. Exactly the same way that I figured out the stone circles in South Africa were used to create an oxygen-rich atmosphere on Earth. Exactly the same way.
I mean, what you're saying is so enormous. Like, you, I mean, that's literally saying that this changed the whole course of our planet.
Yes, I believe that's exactly what we're looking at here. We're looking at the giant machine that made our planet habitable, either after a giant, apocalyptic
cataclysm
that blew everything up and reduced our planet to a wasteland, and they needed to restart the planet. That's why they went to all this trouble and this so much extent to build millions of these structures, or it was literally building up the planet from scratch. That this is actually the origins of the world, where they turned it into a habitable environment.
I was just watching Ancient Aliens this morning, and they had these hollow spheres that they were talking about that they were just laid out, looked like people just scattered them all over the world. And I think they may have some in Africa also, and they thought that this were how they created like bacteria, which created, you know, the planet. I don't, you know, I didn't get a focus too much on it. I just heard it in the background, but
who knows, man? Could be.
Yeah. Interesting stuff.
Yeah, look, I'm of the opinion that there's a higher level of consciousness behind all of this. That, you know, you can't create something from nothing. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in my scientific logic.
Are you getting closer at all to understanding this? I know the puzzle keeps getting more and more complex. But are you starting to kind of see, like, now you feel that this was an oxygen generator? Are you sort of putting this whole thing into a linear story now that you can kind of piece it together as you keep going along here?
Yeah. What I do need to look at is whether the stone circles that are still covered by soil and sand across the mountains and, you know, the plains here in our province, whether those stone circles that are still covered, if those are also built and made from fossils, because I have not yet determined that 100%. I know that most of the ruins that I've been visiting and exploring and researching are made of fossils. And not only that, even the terraces that are extremely old, that just are mind-blowingly old, that cover entire mountains, are also fossils. This is mind-blowing stuff. So this is just making this
think about all the different species that could be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is why finding these body parts, the legs of creatures that you can clearly see where they were cut and like and hung up and prepared for consumption and for eating, and then ones that have been eaten and chewed and claw marks in them and teeth marks in them and literally like cut steak, pieces of steak. It's just everywhere. And so there was obviously a lot of activity going on, a lot of consumption of creatures the way we eat cows and sheep today. Either these creatures were being harvested for food, or they were just being hunted and eaten. And at the same time, we have nearly 500,000 square kilometers of agricultural terraces. Keep this in mind. Okay, this is not a small, this is an insane amount of work that would take millions and millions of people to create over, probably, you know, hundreds of years, if not thousands of years.
Didn't you think, Michael, that this was just, they used this to feed the rest of the world possibly?
Yes, and this is interesting because I've been studying Anton Parks' work, which is really critical. Anyone that is interested in the Sumerian texts and the Sumerian translations has to go from Zachariah Sitchin and move on to Anton Parks, because Anton is in my opinion, unquestionably the highest authority on the Sumerian language and how the other languages in the world could all connect to the Sumerian language, and how Sumerian was the prototype language for all global languages, including the pictographic languages of the East. And Anton is a master translator of the Sumerian texts. And he talks about these special places that were set up by the Anunnaki, that they were growing vast amounts of food for all their activities around the world. And I'm suspecting that this might have been it.
It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. Hey, is there anything new with the Adams calendar? I mean, have you noticed? I mean, that's still an active working calendar, right? You still can tell the day of the year from that.
It's the oldest working sun calendar on Earth.
That's so amazing.
It's very clear. You know, we have references, as Zachariah Sitchin describes a few places in his books, in his translations, that are, you know, it's, you can't make it up. You can't. The translation that I use that I found in one of his books, he says, 40 shahr after arriving on Earth, Enki built himself a place of observing in the deep Abzu on the edge of a cliff, with his abode aligned with his abode in the north and the peaks. It's like describing Adam's calendar to the T.
How does that work? How does that work as the Earth rotates and it changes? Because, you know, when we're supposed to the polar shift. How does that work as, you know, a million years changes the calendars? And
well, you know, I don't know. I have some theories on this, but that takes us into a whole different subject, and that is the shape of our Earth.
Right.
How much do we really know about the shape of our Earth?
Please say round, Michael. Please don't.
Do we believe NASA, or is the Earth a different form of energy? Okay, and I'm not going to go in the direction that you think I'm going.
Good.
I'm going to go in the direction of saying, and I do this in my lectures and presentations, is that everything in this reality of ours, and this is what scientists and researchers need to really embrace. Unless and until they embrace this, they constantly reach the incorrect conclusions because they start from the wrong point of understanding or comprehending the source material. And everything in this reality of ours, from the smallest subatomic particle, if you can call it that, to electrons, to atoms, to everything else, to molecules, everything manifests, and sound and magnetism, especially sound and magnetism, manifests in toroidal fields, perfectly balanced toroidal fields. If you've seen Thrive, the movie, and Nassim Haramein and all the clever people in there, how they show the giant toroidal structure of our galaxy and of other galaxies, everything manifests in toroidal fields, okay, are not the structure that we've been taught over the last 120 years. That's all nonsense. That's a theory that was put out there, and that theory has stuck. The atomic model is so complex and filled with problems that, unfortunately, I go through all of this in my lectures. I go through what I call the particle physics agenda, and this is a deep, deep problem that we need to embrace. So while we marvel and we're blown away by these discoveries of these ancient civilizations, their technology and the fossils and the giants, and by the way, we've got giants, I've got bones of giants and hearts of giants that are 500 meters tall. This is not, you know, a few feet big. I'm talking about what the Book of Enoch talks about.
I said Book of Enoch said 1 mile tall.
Exactly.
Unbelievable. That's hard to comprehend. That's hard to comprehend.
And then we got to go back. We got to go back to oral tradition, oral history that's been handed down for thousands and thousands of years. And modern science has poo-pooed and dismissed oral tradition, oral history as, you know, old housewives' tales and nonsense like that. And that is the big problem, because remember who drives modern science and modern research are the same people that control the governments and the puppet masters of the world, the guys with the agenda to keep us dumbed down and enslaved through the money and the socio-economic systems that we are trapped in. So pretty much everything we've been told is a lie. So if you believe that the government is lying to us, if you believe that the secret agencies like CIA are lying to us, if you believe that the petroleum and energy companies are lying to us, if you believe that the pharmaceutical companies are lying to us, then surely NASA must also be lying to us. That can't be the exception to the rule.
Well, I always said,
spot on.
I've told this a couple times about SETI, having somebody on from SETI
too, yeah.
And they, you know, they were the UFO or the alien hunters, the best ones in the world. And then you get on, they're like, yeah, I don't really believe it. And you're like, what? I mean, how do you not believe something's out there? I mean, so I do agree with you on that. And the people in the chat room are loving you, by the way. And I was going to show these pictures because, I mean, if you go back to ancient, you know, scripts, you know, biblical times, and a lot of our portraits and art or hieroglyphs, a lot of them show giants, and we've found giants throughout the world. It's not just over in Africa, but there's here in America. There's been several giants that have been
everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
They are everywhere. I just had somebody send me a picture on 2 days ago about someone in Hawaii plowing their land and plowing up a huge piece of a spine. I mean, it's this wow. size.
Oh, my God. Amazing.
So
and once you know how to spot fossils, it's really easy because they don't look like rock. Mm. They look like something else. And if it doesn't look like rock, if it doesn't smell like rock, if it doesn't taste like rock, if it rock, then it's not rock. Right.
He's right.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, and I was going to ask the ruins that you find, you know, millions of them. Do you find that there's more energy in a certain area than others? Like Stonehenge is considered an energy source, a portal to another world. Do you find there's more energy in certain spots than others?
Well, I can't say that I have found that, but what I do know is that the moment you build a stone circle, you've created an energy generating device, and this is why the ancients built stone circles.
Right.
Until they well, I guess we have the great example here of millions of stone circles and how they should be built.
Right.
And these circles here are built, as I teach in my lectures, they built along the cymatic patterns of the sound coming out of the earth at that specific point. So this is really important, why to figure out why each stone circle is completely unique and why it has a certain shape. Because the shape of every stone circle simply represents the cymatic pattern or the shape of the sound that comes out of the earth at that point. And this is a really important discovery, because this leads us and connects us to why the stone circles have been so amazing in helping people to heal and be cured from various diseases. Because basically the stone circles are amplification chambers or machines of the subtle frequencies of the earth. And they just amplify the frequencies millions and millions of times, and so that we can actually measure them with our very basic measuring instruments. Also, keep in mind that these stone circles and the torus stones, by the way, that generate scalar energy. And again, I can speak volumes about this, why I know this, why I can say this with absolute confidence. This is technology because it uses sound, and sound itself is a scalar mode. Sound travels in and creates scalar energy waves. Wave is the wrong word as well. And these stone circles because they amplify the natural frequencies of the earth, I have since 2008 found repetitive stories of people that have come on tour with me, especially when they're exposed to the stone circles for longer periods of time, that experience unbelievable healing, from some benign illnesses and diseases to full-blown cancer, where the person was about to die and came to South Africa on this tour knowing that after this they were probably going to die. When they went back to the USA, went to the doctor said, "What have you been doing?" And because your cancer is receding at a rapid rate, it's like half of it's gone.
Wow.
And then they came back on another tour of stone circles with me, and they went back and their cancer was clear. So
unbelievable. That's interesting, because there's supposed to be something to the sound resonance really of the earth.
The stone circles amplify the natural frequencies of the earth. And because we in the modern crazy world with, you know, electrosmog and all the horrible frequencies that are channeled into our air and into our homes and Wi-Fi and all this crap that we're using to communicate, which we should be able to use very non-invasive frequencies that exist, as you know. Anyway, when you stand close to the stone circle or inside the stone circle, you start to resonate with the amplified frequencies of the earth, the natural frequencies. And those natural frequencies are the frequencies that we should be vibrating and being in coherent harmonic resonance with the earth. Otherwise, we are in dis-ease. We are in dissonance and dis-ease, and we get sick and we die. So the stone circles bring you back into harmonic, coherent resonance with the earth.
Do you physically feel it, Michael, yourself? Can you stand there and feel it?
Well, I certainly can. And I'm an insensitive bastard, as I always say. But there are people that are that can feel energies very strongly, as you know. Some people are really empathic, and very sensitive to feeling energy and so forth. And I've had, you know, diverse reactions, extreme different reactions from people going into the stone circles, and especially Adam's calendar, and also recently into the magnetron shaped ruins. Oh my goodness, you know, the magnetron shaped ruins are so powerful. They literally make some people want to pass out, and other people just off with euphoria.
It's fascinating stuff, I'll tell you. I mean, that's one of the most exciting places I think to travel to right now would be to go down there and see this stuff. What do you think, Tony?
Oh, let's go. But until then, in a few weeks, we're going to be seeing Michael at Contact in the Desert. You can go to contactinthedesert.com or go to michaeltellinger.com, see all his upcoming events. I know he's going to be touring America after Contact, so maybe you'll get a chance to see him there. Michael, we're so excited to have you here, as always. It's a pleasure and an honor, and we hope to see you soon and then get to talk to you in a few weeks.
Yeah, awesome, guys. Thanks so much. Always great to see you and to talk to you. Look forward to seeing you in person at Contact in the Desert, and it's going to be an awesome event. So anyone that's out listening to the show, watching this, come to Contact in the Desert.
Awesome.
And make sure you subscribe to this channel right now and share this episode. This information needs to get out so everybody can take a tour down to South Africa.
Support it. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, we'll see you guys soon, and see you next time on Truth Be Told.